Good morning. This is the Tuesday edition of Down to Brass Tacks, 4341790. 266-4862 is our WhatsApp number, and you can send a message to that number, or you can send an email to brasstacks@starcomnetwork.net. John Stout is taking care of all things technical. He's the producer, technical operator, and he answers the phone as well. Multitasking. I'm Dennis Johnson, your host, and we go until 2 o'clock this afternoon. Got to share this with you, and thanks to my friend and former colleague who sent me this. Got to share this with you. 500,000 sharks could be killed and harvested to develop a COVID-19 vaccine, Conservation Group Shark Allies is warning. Squalene, I hope that's the correct name, an oil found in shark livers, is used in cosmetics and medicines, including potential COVID-19 vaccines, which are already being produced. The oil helps to strengthen the immune response, which increases the effectiveness of potential vaccines. Harvesting something from a wild animal is never going to be sustainable, especially if it's a top predator that doesn't reproduce in huge numbers. That's what the founder and executive director of Shark Allies said to Sky News. There are so many unknowns of how big and how long this pandemic might go on, and then how many versions of it we have to go through, that if we continue using sharks, the numbers of sharks taken for this product could be really high year after year after year. I will save you all the in-betweens about how many are killed and go to the end, which says alternatives to the oil can be extracted from plants and algae, which could be used as a potential replacement for the sharks. Amyris, a squalene producer in California, draws the oil from sugarcane so quickly that the company could produce enough for 1 billion vaccines in a month. That's according to the petition from those trying to save the sharks. Sugar cane. Brass Tacks, good morning.
Good morning, Dennis.
Morning, Glenn. How are you?
Good morning. How are you, sir?
I am.
Fascinating stuff. Absolutely fascinating.
I don't know whether to be fascinated or whether to hold my hand and ball, of course.
I'm always intrigued by human behavior.
I know you are, but you know, Glenn, here's the message in this message, right? We talk about research and development. We talk about acreage being given to the University of the West Indies, Cavehill campus, for acreage and development. We talk about the herb, marijuana by whatever name. And the last time I had a discussion, I got a message saying that Jeremy, Stephen, and I, two people that know nothing about marijuana, talking about marijuana. I don't know anything about marijuana, that's the truth. But I had the distinct pleasure of being asked to host a discussion on decriminalizing of marijuana in Barbados and the effect it would have on the human resources, you know, practitioners.
Right. Right.
And one of the things I found out from that was that the products that were being allowed into Barbados were developed using synthetic cannabis and not the real thing that we were growing anyhow. And I sat there going, so why are we talking about developing an industry and doing this and doing that when it's the synthetics that were being used to produce the things that we claim we were going to produce?
Because I suspect, you know, we don't have the deep pockets and the financial resources that are necessary to go into synthetic research, any research of any kind.
But we always end up in the same position. It's why I keep saying, Glenn, and people don't seem to understand why I say it.
Yeah.
It's because we keep getting pushed all the time.
Sidetrack.
Yeah.
I'm being sidetracked myself.
Okay, let me not sidetrack you anymore.
Great. Well, like as I said earlier, as a student of human behavior, whether it be the individual, the group, society, I'd like to put a perspective, a different perspective on the result of Santa Moore's candidature as a member of the Barbados Labour Party in coming by election. And as such a student of human behavior, I am not motivated by motives, either individually, as a group, or as an institution, or as a society. I am interested in the action, the function, and the value of such a function, how it results positively or negatively on a society. In other words, the old people would say in Barbados, if the Lord said it, and the devil bring it, it is take it. You don't worry about the motivation, right? You don't worry about the message, you worry about the function it performs. The Lord said it, the devil bring it, but you take it because the Lord said it. So in that regard, I would like to look at is that what matters most is, in the case of Sandra Moore in this by-election, it's not how she was elected or why she was elected or the motives why she was elected. What matters to me most is how would that materially change the representation of the workers, through the workers' union, either from the Senate or the House, either down the Senate as against as the House. And in doing that, I'd like to quote no less a person than Sir Roy Troutman, who had been in the Senate, I think, from 1994 to 2018. I hope I got my figures right. Right? And he said in Barbados Today on the 25th of September, quote, the paper said, Sir Roy is adamant that once Senator Moore gets to sit in Parliament, she can then speak on a, listen, do a deeper and wider level on issues, on a deeper and wider lesser issue. And then he went on. So Roy added Senator Moore accepts that now she would be better because she would be able to speak from a better and bigger platform. Right. So that triggered me. What do you mean by that? I mean, all the matters, virtually except for money bills, all the matters that come to the Senate are debated in the House of Assembly. January 1st, right? Only money bills don't come to the Senate. Mm-hmm. Because the people in the Senate are not elected and therefore they shouldn't be determined on how you spend the taxpayers' money in certain regards. But therefore, and in the Senate, a senator is, as Sir Roy Troutman would know, can speak on any matter that comes on workers or whatever. He speaks in the House, I think unless the standard also changed for a vote, the issue is about half an hour or so. In the House of Assembly, I think the Senate are probably the same. The only person gets a longer period of time to speak on behalf of the workers or labor or whatever, would be if a minister who introduces a bill speaks sometimes for an hour or so, and then at the end that minister is able, or anybody who introduces the bill, is able to wrap up the debate and answer questions or whatnot. So basically the same rules that apply for in the Senate applies to a member of the MP in the House of Assembly. I am therefore wondering how will it be bigger and better and deeper and wider in the House as from the Senate?
The prestige of being a voted representative as opposed to a selected representative, I presume.
Yeah, but that doesn't add to the quality of the representative on the research, the information, how it's structured, how it's delivered, and the sense that it makes, whether it's bodes for the evil or the good of the country or the workers. So I'm a little confused in that regard, and therefore that has set me running. In addition, you know, I have followed the development of the workers' union just after the beginning. I was born just around the beginning of the formation of Barbados Workers' Union. So therefore, I'm fully conversant with a lot of the history that obtains regarding workers and representation. First of all, you have to understand that all, as a result of the overthrow of the institutionalized plantocracy, colonialism in Barbados, to a large extent, politically and practically, not necessarily financially, with the coming of universal death service in 1951, and then any other party, since then, the Barbados Labour Party, Democratic Labour Party, virtually all other parties that came out with the socialist orientation and philosophy, with the plot of the lot of the Marxists, the plight of the Maras is their major concern, and they seek to better the matter of the workers' class and the workers. That all other parties have exposed this support for the Maras. Any party has suffered at the hands. That is why you no longer have a conservative party in Barbados. There used to be a conservative party. I think then that changed into the Barbados National Party, and then it changed into the Motley Team, and then it died because it was against the philosophy and the general attitude and consensus of the Barbados society that politics was bettering the society, but you had to take special solid consideration given to the plight and lot of the workers, the masses, who had been disenfranchised and disadvantaged for hundreds of years by slavery and colonialism, and then the plantocracy ruining Barbados. So I think that any, and therefore that's why you've never seen the return of a conservative party in Barbados.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, it is a given. It is a given to me that representation of working, any party in Barbados nowadays who comes to propose to support a conservative, as I said, a conservative, really mean the moneyed, traditional,
money
white
class. Yeah. The business market class. Yeah.
Business class.
Mm-hmm.
We get short shrift. They wouldn't survive.
Mm-hmm.
For right. So therefore, it is a given. And I would like to think then that apart from that, you have a Ministry of Labour. You have a minister who has access to all kind of information, has research staff, has a whole slew of officials that police and service that ministry. You have a Labour Department Chief Labour Officer named. So Labour is recognised and accepted in the society, institutionally and politically.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a slew of legislation that represents the interests of workers. And there's the social partnership.
Yeah, but Glenn, listen, back up a minute. Back up a minute, okay? Because I've said this openly and I'll say it again. What is so unique about this particular move by Senator Moore? I have pointed out that in various Caribbean islands, I'm sure you're aware of this because you've been around I think longer than I have, from Chedijegan in Guyana all the way up to Bustamante and Manly in Jamaica. Union leaders have been prime ministers or premiers or heads of government. So what's the difference?
No, I'm not challenging her right to be. I'm based on some of the spin, the argument, the twists that are being given to justification. And I'm taking out, I'm saying that if she's obviously a talented woman. I have nothing against her. From all appearance, all I've seen of her, she's a talented young woman. Given. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't even mention the fact that she went to compromise. That I wouldn't mention that at all.
Mm-hmm.
But the point I'm a functionalist. You focus on what does it do that somebody has not done. I'm saying that given that the existing arrangement, given the entitlements in the House of Assembly, in the Senate to debate similar and most often the same issues, I do not, and you'll be debating the same person with all the abilities and skill and training. Apart from that, as the consultation that takes part at the social partners, so I'm saying that by itself, that being in itself does not make for a better representation. Particularly when there are so many other institutions that provide a wider
The only argument I could put to that, Glenn, is this: as a member of the party, as a member of the party that sits in government, perhaps what the General Secretary of the Barbados Workers Union can do is have a more direct and forceful input into the crafting of policies and framework in a political environment that would have more gravitas, more pull, more push than social partnership, than senatorial appointments, independence in the Senate, and all the other things. It would have a direct input into the seat of government from sitting in cabinet. The justification is one for the politicians. Thanks for your contribution. This is Down to Brass Tacks. Good morning.
Good morning, Sir Dennis.
How are you, sir?
I good. Now I'm going to drag you into something that you don't like.
Which is?
Richard's politics, but I
who
do.
Tell you I don't like it? Who tell you I don't like it?
I'm going to start off with what you read, paternity, the sugar industry. Now, you see how important sugar is. You know, sugar is the only industry in Barbados that is also a manufacturer. You start all the other industries bringing raw material. Even like my man, Nasser, who speak about his raw iron business. And he talk about manufacturing. And all the furniture and such, like all the bringing material to do such. But the very manufacture of sugar come from the industry itself. It is planting the sugar, reaping the sugar cane, and then manufacturing sugar. You see how important it is? And I heard you mention my pet subject, my pet part of the sugar industry. That how come all of these years, that good piece of land, those good acres of land, that was handed to the university, if you pass there now, Dennis, the grass is longer than sugar cane, and nothing is happening. That is enough for the sugar industry and manufacturing, the only unique industry that manufacture the same thing. Now, I heard you made mention just now to Glenn pertaining to the trade union movement. Dennis, in the early colonial days, when the West Indies or the Caribbean countries were trying to take over or was on the infantile stages of taking over colonialism, the Barbados progressively then was forming Barbados, but it was not as accepted to the people by name. But what they did is they recognized that in Jamaica, who was carrying out the same struggle against colonialism, used the word labor. So they changed the Progressive League to the Labour Party, which would have redone to the massive sugar workers that we had in Barbados at the time. I can remember one time people would tell you, if you go to work at a factory, I had the experience. Man, you should not be working here. You're not a labourer. You're not a labourer, right? They had that connection built within them, within the plantation system, that as long as it is a Labour Party, it had a connection to them. We have passed that stage. And I can carry you now to the origin of the first trade unionists of Barbados that entered Parliament. So Frank Walcott, I have no documentation on his separation from Sir Grantley Adams, but I understood when the first ministerial government was formed that he wanted a ministry, and Sir Grantley told him, go and represent the workers. That union, you belong to that. So Frank Walcott then in St. Peter, and it must be recorded that he is the first trade unionist that ran independent and was elected to Parliament. That is 61 up to 66. He was elected in a Labourite constituency called, in those days, St. Peter, St. George, St. Joseph, and St. Thomas had a very heavy labour force involved in the sugar industry. And he got his nod in St. Peter. The mistake he made is when he went and formed affiliation with the Democratic Labour Party and ran in 66 and was defeated as a Democratic Labour Party person. Now let me come a little further up into the formation or the rebuild of the Barbados Labour Party, because the Labour Party went through years of defeat between 61 and 76 until Tom Adams came Prime Minister, the late and great Tom Adams, who I said he's a Prime Minister that I always accepted for the mobility that he pushed into the sugar workers by giving them the opportunity to own their own piece of land. Now, let me say this. Tom Adams was very adamant as leader of the Barbados Labour Party that no trade unionist should be in Parliament, because he said at that time that we have developed to a stage that the government of itself as an employer of workers. So you cannot be part of the government or the sitting government party ways and represent the workers fairly because you're part of the body. And it is set about in 1976 after Frank Walcott moved from St. Peter and he was elected in St. Michael between 71 and 76. And that was at the point that Tom Ellis put all of his energy against Frank Walcott and said, no, he should stay out there and represent the workers. He said the next person I'd be going after was the Negroes because they have a right to represent the workers and not being affiliated with an employer because he said the government is an employer. And this is what I would say today, that the present person who running and talking about she bringing labor, let her understand that the government is an employer too. And this is the mistake that a lot of our electorates are not facing. So you can't have all... it is amazing, you know. I have so much to say, Dennis, that I don't want to tell you today. But we can talk at brief with this here. Because I heard Saroy on the news the other night with a double standard. He said that because of the union talking about diversification of agriculture, that he heard it in the strong speech. Well, if you could be effectively given the idea of the folk in Parliament, how come that you have to have some person in Parliament and talking about the labour force? And at the same time, let me say this to the public. We got to be sensible. If Saroy knew that it is very important for a labour, a person of a union should be in Parliament, ask Saroy why he resigned from Parliament.
So because he had differences. So because, you see, sometimes, right, this is the challenge I have. When I say I don't like getting into political discussions, especially personal politics, because of what you've just done. And let me walk you through it slowly.
Man,
hold on, now, man. Don't jump all over the place. Just hold
man,
on. I listen to you long and carefully. You've placed an argument on the table. That said, Tom Adams said he did not want unionists involved in politics, go out there and represent the workers, okay?
Yes.
Sir Roy Trotman was in Parliament. He had a difference of opinion with the political party and stepped out to do what you said, represent the workers. He marched, he made a decision. I've said so. The last time I was on air, I'll say so the next time I was on air. Union leaders have a choice to make when it comes down to, do I support the party or do I support the workers who employ me? And that is the decision they have to make. Evelyn Graves stepped back from being the principal of the Labour College to be a minister of tourism. You make a decision. When the workers marched against the hotels, he did not march with the unions. He stood inside the hotel in St. Peter. He represented St. Lucie at the time, I think, as the Minister of Tourism, and looked at them. But I'm sure he understood the challenge he was facing. So the problem we have in Barbados, as I've seen in other Caribbean islands, so I don't think it's unique to Barbados, is that we get so tied up in the personalities involved and the parties that we support because of the personalities that we lose sight of the principle that we keep saying that we have. And that's the problem I have with discussing politics. Because I could discuss politics from any angle because I have no interest in the personalities involved other than the fact that whether I like them or I don't like them at a parliamentary, at a personal, or at a political level. And I try to keep that closely guarded because then people will see the wrong thing. It's just like people keep asking me about whether I will hug a man and kiss a man and tell a man that I love him because they want me to come out and make some statement about same-sex marriage. And I keep telling them, that ain't got nothing to do with me. It does not affect me one way or the other. They tell me, oh, you're trying to be on both sides and you don't want to offend your colleague and all sorts of garbage that have nothing to do with the fact that I say to them, it don't matter to me. They don't understand that. So, and that's the problem I have with politics.
All right,
not that I don't like it. I love it.
Let
I love it
to
bits.
Dennis.
Yes, sir.
let me finish on this here. Mm-hmm. And it cannot go unless I make
this
a sort of, give this, I will call it an opportunity call to Glenn Clark.
Yeah.
Glenn was my personal friend. Glenn came up as a very quiet person. Comparing the present candidate with Glenn is chalk and cheese. I don't even think that Glenn Clark was really a politician, Dennis.
Well, perhaps he was a real
Glenn
good
Clark
one.
Glenn Clark was more a community person.
That's what politicians should be.
Than a politician.
So that's what politicians should be, representative of the people, member of parliament for the constituency of. That's what it is.
But what I am saying, the sort of rancor and thing like that, Glenn never involved in that. Never, ever. And he was truthful. And I can tell you how we begin and how we finish. Then Glenn Clark became a member representing St. George under the Barbados Labour Party banner in 19... He ran in 91 and lost. And in 1994, then he won. And people expected that when to go to Glenn, that they would need help. And Glenn was very open. Glenn told them, I am only a parliamentary secretary so far. I am not in any position to help you all, but I will beg. That is how we begin. He had the opportunity, unfortunate, he had two ministries, housing and communications, and work where he could have helped some people, and he did just that. This last election, which I participated on every platform with him, apart from the national meetings, then he won, he had expected to receive a ministry. That is his expectation. He did not receive the ministry. And then people went to him. He was very open and fair to them. He said, I am not a minister. I am not in any position to help you all. Neither am I, listen to the words, neither am I going to beg any of their members for the front bench, because I was in there before them and I'm begging them. So that is what I have to say pertaining to Glenn. He was upright. He was truthful. Even the other night, I heard him with a clipping on the radio, and he told the people, there's a lot of people out there that want work, and he said nobody is to go hungry, and they have vouchers. There are other politicians who try to hide it. He said they got vouchers, and you could come and get a voucher if you're hungry. And that is my conclusion on Glenn Clark, as the former representative of St. George, and the people in St. George know me very well, and they know that what I'm speaking is true.
All right, sir. Brass Ducks, good morning.
Blessed day.
To you too.
To you and all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The same-sex union, this to say about the civil union, was that?
What?
When
you don't know what a civil union is?
Yeah.
You don't know what a civil union is?
Explain it to me, please.
A civil union is when two people get married in the court.
Oh, in court.
Mm-hmm.
So when they speak about marriage, they're going to have a referendum on gay marriages. What's the difference?
Ma'am, you don't know the difference between a marriage and a civil union? A marriage happens in a church and then it goes to the courthouse to be made civil. A civil union takes place anywhere by a magistrate, justice of the peace, and has nothing to do with the court, with the church, and it's called a civil union. It is recognized as the state as being a marriage because the state is the recognizing body of such unions. But if you and I went and stood up in Independence Square and had a justice of the peace join us, whether he read from a Bible or whether he had some ceremony that made no reference to what God has joined together, it's called a civil union. Now, whether we consider it a marriage or the state considers it a marriage is a matter for the state. And the state does recognize those unions. They do so now.
So if they recognize civil union, Why a referendum?
So that persons like yourself who object to the use of the term marriage will have a chance to say whether...
You can't say may object.
Ma'am, of course you do. Ma'am, you have made it clear that you objected before. Ma'am, you have made it clear before that you object to it. So I'm just saying. Okay. So you don't object. Okay, you don't object. Fine. I withdraw that statement. So that people who have an objection to the state recognizing the sanctity of marriage as stated by their biblical perspectives will have a chance to say yes or no. That better? Does that satisfy your question?
I am thinking if you're married in a civil union, that is it.
Really?
The only thing difference there would be then the church. But if you don't believe in church and all that, does it matter to the persons if they are in a civil union?
I don't think it matters to the persons.
Right.
It don't matter to the law either, because the law recognizes civil unions.
Right. So to me, David, the only thing about it I will go on to say is I hope that when all this is passed and so on, that there will be fair age limits to who can get into civil union and same sex.
But there is a limit, ma'am. Ma'am, there is.
Because under, let me finish, under 18, when you're 18, you're an adult, right?
Correct.
So our children need to be protected until they can decide for themselves certain things. So that I see it as making provisions that there's under 18, it will be a no-no.
Ma'am,
so don't just
ma'am, hold on. Ma'am, you're not listening to me. Just listen to me for a second, please. It already exists. If you're under 18 and you want to get married, whether in the church or in a civil union, you have to have the permission of your parents. That's the law. I can't get married to a 13-year-old or a 14-year-old.
I say this is because they say from 16.
No, ma'am, that's the age of sexual consent.
Right.
Don't get tied up. Don't get tied up.
Sexual consent is 16.
Correct.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So, that's what I'm looking at. That's what I was really seeking to find out.
Ma'am,
how far this
you know that differs from country to country, right?
Right. When they pass laws, though, I want it to be any law clearly put out there so that the halfway thing. Let me hear, let me see what's going to be happening. Right.
And you think that will change anything?
Yeah.
What will change?
Let us change?
Here.
Let us spell out, just like how you would spell out. Okay, you go to court and they have witnesses and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So that you would know how this thing happened, whatever. Spell out what is to be. So that you wouldn't be surprised and say, oh, this thing was already passed. So therefore. Later.
Okay, ma'am, let me ask you this
situation.
Question. If you're making that distinction, right?
Mm-hmm.
How come you did not know what I just told you before about the age of consent and marriage and the difference?
I know what the age of consent is,
so,
but the union, because you know what I asked the question, I can't remember if it's Caswell, somebody said that means they will have to outlaw, buggery, they will have to change the laws about buggery.
Mm-hmm.
If this civil union, which is true, but they didn't start out with changing the laws of buggery. They started out with civil union. Get where you're coming from?
No, ma'am, I don't. I don't.
You don't what?
I don't get where you're coming from.
Listen. They didn't say we're going to change the laws about buggery. They didn't say that. But following the
ma'am.
Civil union, we know that the law of buggery.
Ma'am,
yes. Yes.
You are confusing two things that I'm trying to get you to unconfuse, and you're not doing it.
All right, I'm listening.
A civil union is a union of two people united outside of a church by law. In other words, a magistrate or justice of the peace joining two people in a civil union.
Mm-hmm.
It does not say they have to be of the same gender. Do you see where your confusion lies now?
Yeah, but I'm talking about persons of the same gender.
Correct, but that's not what you're saying. And you're saying that it must be clearly spelled out, but you're not saying so. And that's what I'm trying to get around to you. There was a gentleman who I think he's a minister of religion, said that they didn't need to go through all that. All they needed to do, if they wanted to allow two people of the same gender to engage in whatever they want to engage in, just remove the law against buggery. But here's the problem. Removing the law against buggery does not address two females who have a relationship. Because as far as I'm aware, I don't know of any female who's been charged with that particular crime. There's also the situation where in the privacy of their room, what people do does not affect the law. There are laws that are passed, and you see, this is the reason why I keep saying it makes no difference to me. Because people pass laws all the time, and we do whatever we want to do. So to say we have a law does not say it can stop. It does not, it will not change anything.
We still can't throw out the law because people don't obey.
Ma'am, I didn't say so, but that's my point. Ma'am, you're underlining my point. My point is, why pass a law that you don't plan to enforce? Why?
Everybody will not disobey the law, so it still needs to be passed. All right. Everybody will not disobey. So I just want to tell the door from the government exactly how this thing will go and everything before they go and pass this file. I really want it spelled out. Also now, I'll go through this quickly. The CSC, the results, I'm glad to hear that the persons in charge are thinking about a review. And I didn't hear that they weren't charging anymore, but they said they will review those who come before them. And I'm glad, I'm very glad about that. Also, I've encouraged parents to pray with their children. I hear people talking about how depressed and down their children are because of the results and this thing. They have to be taught to balance the emotions in these times, especially those who are planning to go overseas and everything. This is a good time to really settle and, you know, these ain't easy times. So I pray that they will get back the results and think everything will be all right, but go with the understanding that there will be disappointments and so on in life. And try not to, you know, trust God in everything. Trust the Lord. And the last thing is, I'm so glad for Miss Letizia. I'm so glad for her. And I think she is doing a good job. And Miss Motley, our Prime Minister, I want to see these two women more or less, you know. I'm looking forward to hearing from both of them. And respectfully, of course. But I think this will be a good going down. These two ladies. All right.
Okay, ma'am. 434-1790-266-4862 or 266-IVOB. You can send an email to brasstacks@starcomnetwork.net. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Johnson.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
Is it okay if I call you Dennis?
So yeah, absolutely no problem at all, man.
It is Leroy.
Yes, sir. I got that voice.
Yes. Listen, I was starting to get back to you, Dennis.
Because?
With the topics that you were discussing. But then I said, but no, I can't blame Dennis because he can only respond to what people bring. And I'm reminded of the old saying, you can carry a cup of water, but you can't make him drink.
Yeah.
You started out this morning with, I think, the most important topic that has been brought to this program for many a year. The fact that sugarcane, that we know how to grow, and that once had us at the pinnacle of industrial activity, that there was an opportunity for this plant and developing this industry. And not a soul, except for a brief reference to it by, I think it was Mr. Murray, had anything to say about it.
It's not important.
When I came across that, the item that you spoke of, I went straight to, you know, we like the internet, and we always use it for all kinds of things except for productive things. But I went straight to Google and looked for the company that uses sugarcane to make the squalene. Now, having established that that company does exist, the next thing I went to was to see if, in fact, there's any scientific evidence that this does happen.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, I came across an article written by, I think it was about five people, peer-reviewed article, three of whom were PhDs, stating that not only can squalene, now the thing is that there are two things. You get squalene with E-N-E from the shark, which is not very stable for use in commercial processes, which then has to be converted to squalene, L-A-N-E, to be used commercially. And that this, in fact, produces a 90 to 99% purity for the production of this product. Now, here it is that we have an opportunity. And I saw comments made by people, but we don't produce, we ain't producing the sugar cane now, and all the sugar that we made, we producing is sold, which is a non-point, because look at the amount of land that we have that is now under bush, number one. And secondly, the sugarcane is something that will grow, and in less than a year, you can harvest.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a physical limit to the amount that we can produce, but certainly it is a crop that we can produce and we can get back into production of it in no time whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So the point that you raised is a point which is telling us that here COVID-19 has brought an opportunity for this country which does not depend on anybody coming into Barbados, but in fact will put large areas of land back into production if we go the right way and also provide employment and, most importantly, foreign exchange for this country. Now, I am going on with this because I want to make this personal point. In 1979, as an undergraduate student at Mona, we were allowed to do one out of faculty course per year. And that year, I did a course called Caribbean Economic Problems. And no less a person than the late Owen Arthur was the lecturer for that in that class. And we had to do a paper. The paper which I wrote was titled Transfer of Technology, The Technological Path to Underdevelopment, in which I showed that the system that we were using for transfer of technology was causing further underdevelopment of our countries. But in fact, there was an alternative route, and that route was based with agriculture at the center, and that instead of having a sugar industry, we should have a sugar cane industry, because sugar is the cheapest product that you can get out of
from
the sugar
cane.
Right? So, you know, when I heard you with that, interestingly, when you said that, my wife said to me, you sent that to Dennis?
And you
I said no, because I was in the process of writing a response to someone who had raised it. I had just mentioned it to her, and immediately after saying it, you came on here and mentioned it. You know, so I don't know if you say great minds think alike.
No, well, I got to say this to you. I suppose it's the same person who sent me the information that you were talking to. And that's why I started off by saying my former colleague and my friend. Because
yes.
here's the challenge that I have Dr. McLean. I'm calling you Dr. McLean on purpose, okay? Don't tell me call you Leroy. I call you Dr. McLean on purpose. My job is down to brass tacks. That's what I do for a living. So I spend a lot of time reading all sorts of things because apparently I have nothing else to do with my time. But people who know me know that I like to read a lot of things, so they send me all sorts of things to read. And every once in a while, something really interesting gets sent to me, like that piece that, you know, you were looking at and I read. And these things intrigue me because I think this is the conversation, the one you are having, that we should have. Because one, we're in a lot of problems economically. Two, tourism, the mainstay of, or the driving force behind our economy for the last 20 plus years, is in, you know, duck's guts might be gently. Because you have cruise ships that have started back cruising, and one of them in the Mediterranean is already seen as a COVID, another spike, and it is going to drive another nail, and people are going to say, I ain't going cruising yet, because the crew members of that ship have COVID-19, have tested positive for it. So we could construct hotels, but the one of the major players here say that, you know, they may have to rethink their drawings in this new COVID environment. That's playing for time. So we don't know how soon they will start. So our cruise business is out, which means the duty-free shops and the other things, ancillary services, taxis, etc., they're not getting income. So the reason why I raised it was this whole question of research. Now, you've been to the University of the West Indies. You've done research. Here's the problem that I have, Dr. McLean. People who have done research into various areas of agricultural development, you did black belly sheep, and you talked about, you know, sugar cane as opposed to just sugar. People poo-poo it. You know, Dr. Blackbelly and Dennis Johnson know everything. Rather than saying, what is the issue that he's talking about? Does it make sense? Is he quoting statistics that are verifiable? Can we have a discussion on this and talk about how we can progress rather than the nonsense that we get tied up in? So I hear you when you talk about leading a horse to water, because you're leading it to water when there is a scarcity of water. So to give the horse water, you have to decide that it's important that the horse get water. Sir, if we're going to spend money sending people to university, if we're going to spend money on research and development, should this not be an area that we put our best minds to look at the sugarcane again, to see what else can be extracted before somebody else overseas comes up with it, does a patent, takes out,
Then
and all this stuff that will bring us money.
But then it's, let me look at even a more, a less sophisticated approach, right?
Mm-hmm.
Molasses, right?
Yeah, we need for rum, yeah.
We make more money from rum than we make from sugar.
Mm-hmm.
But every time we talk about the sugar cane, the first thing we talk about is sugar.
Sugar, correct.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But we make more money from rum, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Cubans, for decades now, have been producing a product to treat high cholesterol from the wax on the sugar cane plant. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
The sugarcane is the most efficient converter of light energy to chemical energy. Okay? There's an additive that is put in fuel that is alcohol-based, which can be made from the sugarcane. But we don't produce any of it. We buy it from somebody else and add it to our fuel. Right? So the point you're making about the research is very important, because I remember when I said I was going to do my research on the genetics of black belly sheep, first people at the university said, you did research on sheep.
I'm not surprised.
You understand? Now, But I'm saying that we should be focusing our attention on research which can make use of resources that we have. And I always tell people, we watch movies and television and all that, and we don't learn anything from it, you know. We only watch it for entertainment value.
Mm.
But two series that I loved were The A-Team and MacGyver. And you know why? Not because of the what seemingly far-fetched ideas that they came up with.
Mm-hmm.
But the message that I always got from them was, when you're in a tight spot, you look around your environment and see what you have.
Correct.
How best can you use what you have in that environment?
Yep.
Get out of the situation you're in.
Sir, and let me tell you, there are Barbadians who can give you first-hand information like that. Philip Alves rowed across the Atlantic, he and another Bajan gentleman. Two Bajan men rowed across the Atlantic. If you have a chat with Phil Alves and his rowing partner, you'll find out all the things they had to do when things break down to make sure they get back to Barbados. These two Bajans, the only thing they did not know, do, as far as I know, is turn salt water into bread. They did not tell me that they did that. But here's the other thing that you mentioned that I want to pick up on, and it's this. You mentioned biofuels. And I've mentioned that before too. I remember reading a popular mechanics back in 1980 something, where the United States, some car manufacturer in the United States, I think it was Chevy, was asked about alternative fuels for cars. And the CEO said at the time that they were never going to develop an engine that used sugarcane produced fuel for cars because...
Until the United States produced it.
He wasn't so crude. He said because there was not enough acreage in the United States to produce enough sugarcane to make it feasible for them to use cane to develop fuel. Not that it couldn't be done, but that there was not enough acreage available in the United States to do it. And I thought that was an interest. So that was back in 1980. I was sitting in a doctor's office with nothing to do, leafing through magazines.
That would bring value to the lands in Brazil and other parts of South America and
Correct.
The Caribbean.
Correct. Correct. But not the United States. If they had owned the lands in those areas, they would have done it. And...
That is the
point they're trying to get across to my people. We sold our seafront land to foreign interests because they placed the value on it, and we accepted that value. Those properties are devalued when there are hurricanes and natural disasters and the sea come and remove the beach. They decide that it's worth less. They sell it for less on the market, and we accept it. We don't put a value on us. We allow somebody else to put a value, and we say, yeah, it is.
But, you know, we're talking about people putting value on your own things, right? As a former student of mine said something to me once, which I always remember. I took a team of students to debating competition in Thailand some years ago. And in these world university debating competitions, the level of racism is amazing. So your team would always make comments, oh, but you all speak English so well.
Well.
You know, and we say, but we have been speaking it from the time we were born. And, you know, and I sat down and I listened to the judges going through and praising how well the team did and all that. And I turned to the person next to me and said, they're going to place us last. And so, you know, I said, because they're giving us these platitudes first to soften the blow. And when we came out, the team that won from Australia said to me, how did we win that? Right? And one of the members of that team, a young lady from Jamaica, said to me, I am finished. I am not debating anymore. I said, why? She said, I did not come here for anybody to validate me. Mm. I know my value.
Yeah.
You understand?
Mm-hmm.
But we are always in a situation where we rely on people of a different ethnicity or a different nationality or whatever to validate what we do. And if someone from this country, I don't care if they're black or white or pink or gray, a person from Barbados coming up with an idea, that idea will be poo-pooed as long as somebody did not hear it from somebody
other than the United States or Britain. Yeah, I'll give you this as my final example of how I see sometimes we don't rationally think things through. There is a property on the West Coast, which is supposed to be the Platinum Coast of Barbados, the rich coast of Barbados, called the Great Escape. It's on the land side. I think it has a cabana or something on the seaside, but it's on the land side.
Mm-hmm.
Cars pass up and down in front, their buses blowing their horns at all hours. Highway 1, busy highway. It's been on sale for over 8 years. The asking price is $18 million. And I keep looking at it and asking myself, if I had $18 million to spend, would I buy a landside hotel on the West Coast, no vision or visibility of the sea because the other side is blocked up? What would I have to charge per room per night to make back my $18 million? What would I do to make it worthwhile for somebody to want to spend large sums with me? And I contrast that with a small property on the South Coast, on the seaside, three apartments, stacked one on top of the other. One is at road level, the other two go down to the sea. Went on sale less than 2 months ago. There's a sold sign on it now. The price, $7 million.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you ask yourself, what about a small South Coast property of three apartments, one two-bedroom, two three-bedrooms, on the seaside, still on the road, but on the seaside, that would make $7 million appealing to someone, and a multi-storied, multi-roomed West Coast property for $18 million can be sold for 8 years. The reason? Somebody sees value in that South Coast property that they don't see in a West Coast property.
Okay.
And my question then always remains when people talk about the appeal of the West Coast in Barbados, exactly what it is you're selling. Because that's the other thing that we don't pay attention to. There was a lady talking to Mr. Ellis the last time I produced for him, where she was talking about difficulties with her husband and herself over the tourism business. And the question that people in the tourism industry, especially those who provide accommodation, have to ask is this: what am I selling? To whom am I selling it? At what price? And does it still make sense to do it that way? That's what every single hotelier has to do on a regular basis.
Yep.
And the same way that they have to do it in this environment, agriculturalists and other Barbadians, even the retail sector, have to seriously ask themselves, what are we selling? To whom are we selling it? At what price does it still make sense to do it? But Leroy, we're not doing it. We keep waiting on some cataclysmic, I don't know what, miracle to suddenly burst forth out of nowhere and we back into the good times. It doesn't make sense.
And then there are the rest of us who spend hours and hours and hours talking about sterile topics, sterile debate, which we have no influence on, whether Ms. Moore becomes a parliamentarian or not is a matter for the people of St. George North now. It's not, as far as I'm concerned, it's not a matter for any further discussion.
Yeah.
And the same-sex unions and whatever will be a matter for the decision of the people whenever the time comes. So I don't see why we can't know some of the energy that we're using discussing what I refer to as sterile, engaging in what I consider a sterile debate. let us start focusing on the things that can make this country survive, because it is rough. And I must say that I met two persons over this weekend who are here on the what do you call it,
the visitor stamp,
or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know that that are here in Barbados now, and quite happy to be. And one is from California, the next one is from London. And they said, well, I said, well, you escaped the fire and you escaped COVID. And they said, we're very happy to be here. And the one for California is working with a high-tech company. So he said he can work from anywhere in the world. So he is happy to be in Barbados. And the other one from London is managing a family business from Barbados. Right? Mm-hmm. So we have to look at creative ways of
earning a dollar. Yep.
On track, rather than engaging in all these debates and discussions that take us nowhere.
And to do this, we have to make sure that our connections, or international internet connections, are solid enough, can take the weight and deliver exactly the speed and the efficiency that those persons rely on, so that their business is done in real time.
And that the services that we provide that they will need are efficient, because they can contact any government agency or any other business that we are required to do business to facilitate their operations, that there is an efficient way in which they can do so.
Sir, and word of mouth will sell us more than anything else in the world.
Precisely.
I'm with you on that, sir. As usual, we end up on a green point. Thank you. Thank you for sharing with me, Leroy. Really good to hear you. A gentleman lost his wallet in Thorpe's St. James. He has need to get hold of it. He needs his bank cards more than anything else, and the other cards in there. If you want to dispose of the deceased national heroes and other persons that may be in there, photographs of them, you know, he's just happy if he gets his card back. If you call us here at 430-7300, which is our switchboard, they can put you in touch with the producer of the program, who has the relevant information. So if you found a wallet somewhere in Thorpe's St. James area, consisting of bank cards and deceased national heroes, please, the owner would like to have it back.